Accession number 1385 6 reel 7.
Reel 7 kamikazes, yes. Yes, right. Well, I had said we'd rather jump the gun, because if I get on to kamikazes, we're in the Pacific now. But I was talking about Ernie King and his resistance to the Navy. Had we got that on the previous day, did we?
Yes.
We done an Ernie King.
Yeah.
But anyway, we landed, we got shore-based at Pitiloo, the island of Pitiloo in Manus Group, the Admiralty Islands. Well, it was hot as hell, about 6 degrees north of the equator. It was sweaty hot. I went ashore at Pitiloo. It was marvelous. The Americans had really dug themselves in, and they had defensive positions all around the island. And when I used to go and see the major in charge of the coastal defenses, he said, "Why, you're welcome," he says. "Come on in." And so he'd open the door of a huge, gigantic deep freeze, if you please. We'd go in there, the steam would smoke out, and he'd pull up a crate of frozen beer, and he'd sit on it. He says, "One for you, Major," because I was a colonel then. I think I was a colonel, yes. So we sit on up 10 crates of beer, and he'd break one open, you know, it was... And we just drink ice-cold beer inside this deep freeze. I thought that was the height of civilization in jungle. Their laboratory arrangements were a bit crude. They used to put a V cross-pole business out into the sea and then put logs across the intersection and build a little platform there. And then they used to put... Further coconut poles used to act as a sort of seat on which you sat. And there were a whole row of bums, you see, all sitting there, having their morning daily. I said, "Well, at least, Captain," I said, "I should have my camera here, have a real picture of a broadside coming out of a U.S. Seabees." It was a really rather amazing way of American solution of a difficult problem. Anyway, that was the time we spent... In Pitiloo.
This is February 1945.
This was in... we'd been through the Battle of Sydney. Sydney was wonderful. You don't mind me harping back, but when we got to Sydney from after Palembang, we went to Fremantle, then round to Sydney, and I took passage in the flagship. And the Australians were pretty pleased to see... After the American invasion, to see the good old British again for a change, because we spoke much the same language, and they're rather archaic drinking laws, which we had to put up with. It was great fun.
What was the Battle of Sydney?
Well, we called it the Battle of Sydney, because the battle was survival, because their hospitality was so overwhelming that anybody, sailors or soldiers, anybody at all in any of the British ships, were overwhelmed with invitations by the Australian generous people. Say, "Thank God you're here." And it was for them anyway, they said, a great relief to talk to people who weren't quite like the Americans, who got so much money. They bought anything and they were pretty angry if they didn't get what they wanted for money. So we were very well looked after by the Australians. So we then went on out to the war again.
I think the next one is Operation Iceberg.
Yeah, well, this is Iceberg. Eventually we got the clearance. King got overruled by Roosevelt, said, "Pull your finger out and get cracking." And I was going to say, the great thing about it was that Vaughan had taken over. We all fear and trembling when Vaughan arrived. We thought he was going to do another Altmark, say the Navy's here, and steam his bloody carriers straight up the old spout, which was a dangerous thing to do. We weren't in that mood, but he turned out to be most affable, when I say affable is not the right word, well, intelligent and willing to learn. I had never, I was so astonished having heard so many stories about the dreaded Bayan, just how eager he was when he didn't know much about the air, not to treat the air like he would during a destroyer attack and rush in without his eyes shut, maybe, hopefully not getting hit. And he, fortunately, I got on very well with him. I respected him anyway, for nothing else. Of course, you know, he was a pretty terrifying-looking chap. He had very beetling blue eyes with huge bushy eyebrows and hair coming out of his ears. It was the most astonishing bloke. And he had a very intense way of speaking. But he was always very kind. He always detected kindness. He really wanted to learn. He used to consult me about almost every subject because I was his admiral, so to speak. And I have to tell you that when we said, well, we're going out, some of us have been in continuous operations for more than a year, and the Americans are, for whom we are going to fight and defend, have been guaranteed, American aviators, that is maximum 6 months. So he put it on the line. He sent a signal to the Admiralty. He said, I insist that none of my aviators are made to stay more than the Americans, i.e. 6 months tour of duty, full stop. And he said he put his resignation on the line if they didn't agree. My God, he could have dropped a bomb amongst the bloody old Admiralty when he did that, because they had to start revising their training schedules like mad. But nobody knew how long the war was going to go on. Could we soon get rid of all our pilots? 6 months turnaround. Good Lord. I mean, I'd been doing 18 months nonstop without... Of course, fortunately, we had the grog in our wardrooms. The poor old yaks, all they had was coffee. But you can't keep going on coffee. I mean, it gives you caffeine sickness or something. But we could get over our problems by a drink or two. All the threats and, you know, psychological pressures. You can reduce it with a few stiff whiskies. We used to have this treatment. I used to have on board ship the same thing. When a chap in real shock, when he'd been in battle and his friend had been shot down, he was a blubbering, almost shivering mess. So his flight commander would talk to him, take him to the wardroom, and his squadron commander would take him. Finally, he's brought up in front of the big white chief, which is me, and I said, look, son, we've all lost people. And said, I'm going to give you a little stiff whiskey, and I'll give you this one, because you're going to come back for another one. And I give him a whiskey, because he thought I was God, you see, in those days. And so I speak kindly to him, told him that it's a long passage. And you go back and have a drink with your mates, and turn in before midnight, and you'll be on duty in the morning. And they were. Of course, the yaks drinking coffee can't get that sort of treatment. It was the only real thing that sustained, I think, our aviators, not just because they were British or got guts or grit or anything, but they had this means of alleviating the tensions. I mean, when you're young, 19, 20, some of these fellows, this type, and you see a fellow shot down in flames and all that, very, very, very undoing. Well, give him a half a dozen strong scotches, and half of it's gone, and by next morning he's eager for battle again. That proved it again and again. So anyway, we got out to Iceberg, which was neutralizing the Shakasima Gunto. I used to fly over the islands surveying all the airfields to see which ones were active and which ones weren't. And then I'd ring up the headquarters ship that was in Dom. I'd say all the code names of the airfields, which ones were working, which ones were not, which ones were still out, you know, that sort of thing. Whether there were any signs of activity. So they planned their subsequent raids on these things. And I used to go out, fly about twice a day, in the morning and in the evening, to see what was left. And say, well, and I used to check up on the bombing raids and taking photographs of them. I used to listen to the strike commander saying, well, we bombed that fair and square. I said, no, you bloody didn't. You missed. And I've got a photograph to show it. You know, I used to get them really snarled up. They didn't like me very much. However, we kept the airfields pretty quiet. So we did Iceberg 1. We then went off and did Formosa. I suppose you knew we had a raid or two on Formosa because we thought that was the main supply route. But it was filthy weather down there. So I had fun shooting up a railway train and one or two other things. That,
successfully?
Well, yes, all these raids had their sort of use, but we didn't succeed in a mission. They thought that bigwigs thought it was exposing the fleet too much to go down there, because if the Japanese had really got going, they might have done us a lot of mischief, but there was nothing there to get going. I think the Japanese were more or less spent by that time. They were concentrating on the home front rather than in Formosa or Taiwan, as it is now. So we went back to our little islands again, and then the next sadness is we thought, well, the good idea of the battleships did a bit of bombardment. Here are these damn great guns and the 16-inch shells and all this damn stupid things. So they tended to do a bombardment. Well, do you know what they bombarded the airfields with? Semi-armored piercing shells. Well, there they were doing a range of 16,000 yards, which is, 12 miles, I mean, quite a long way. And they're coming straight down. This is what they should have done on the Bismarck. Stay out at range and have vertical descending shells. But semi-armor piercing, almost as bad as armor piercing. They go straight through the... They were all coral reef, these islands, you know. And the size of a 15-inch shell, shall we say, it's about a foot or something like that. You'd make a lovely little hole. You go all the way down. You go down about 20 feet and go boom. And all it would do is blow a lot of stuff to the surface, so make a hole in the, underneath, a cavity. Well, didn't take depth very much time. Shovel in a few shovels of shit and fill up that hole. You really wanted a surface blast, you know, which made a great big crater. But even so, they got plenty of machinery to do that sort of thing.
Where were they shelling?
The runways. They were trying
Whereabouts?
Where? In the Shakushima Gunto. Ishigaki, here I come. Shakushima. Oh, yes, don't we know? There was nothing much there. We shot down a few Japanese, and then we had a few kamikazes. Well, that was not very nice. Kamikazes, when you're on deck with a full deck load of aircraft, all fully armed and full of fuel, long-range tanks, of course, and you're turning into wind, and the kamikazes, this is when they want to catch the carriers with a full deck load to fly off. We were doing a deck range there. And we couldn't hear, because with the engines all running, see, it makes quite a noise. And nobody speaks to you on the radio when you're turning off into wind. You get hand signals about flying off. But you could see what's going on, because suddenly there were bloody back poofs from the sky. There was anti-aircraft devices. And I looked across and I saw Ndom being hit. Well, Ndom was only about six cables away. And I was in Vic. And I thought, well, you know, and when you're strapped in, I was right on the outside edge. Ship was turning hard over and to port. And so, you know, the whole aircraft leans. No, it was going to starboard, that's right. So I looked down there and there was the sea straight underneath me. And these kamikazes. And of course, if they'd hit a deck range, we'd have all been written off. It would have been a monstrous explosion. It's not very nice. But fortunately, we weren't hit at that moment. So I was being the leader. I was the first off. I was very pleased to be the first off. Yet the other sergeants catch me up. But we got away with it. And when I went away, they'd hit Victoria. She was hit three times by kamikazes. When we got back to Manus, or was it, no, it was Leyte, I think it was. we were at anchor, and I saw two or three gentlemen in civilian clothes walking on the flight deck. So I went up, because normal naval courtesy, and said, as you say, excuse me, can I help you, gentlemen? Is there anybody you'd like to meet, or, sort of thing? Why, yes, says the guy. He says, we're looking for the CV that's been kamikaze, you see. And I said, well, you're standing right on one right here. Oh, gee, they really were astonished. So I said, well, like St. Thomas, I said, come, I will let you put your hand in the hole. But it's been covered up a bit, so I led them up to where we'd lost a dozen chaps in the port forward turret, where there'd been the first one that hit, and the scars on the deck where the kamikaze had bounced on the second time, and the third one, I can't remember. And I said, well, there, that's all temporary sheeting. That put that turret out of action, and we had this all welded up. I got a picture of it somewhere in my things, of the welding. Jeez. Of course, Formidable got hit, blew a hole, and she was out of action for, I think, 4 hours before they'd repaired everything, swept all the debris over the side, and was steaming again. Of course, they'd lost a lot of aeroplanes as well. But the ship was steamworthy. So the chaps have to be amazed. It was the one trump card that we had over the Yanks, who got all the brains, all the intelligence, all the modus operandi, and the brains, and the knowledge of how to do it. But there's one thing they lacked. They had wood decks on top of tin. So every time a kamikaze hit, it was right down below, and they were all hell fire. And they were reduced. Their carrier strength was very much reduced by this. So we're very glad to have the goddamn Limeys for a change. Anyway, I left before the final end of the war. My 18 months was over.
How did you come to leave?
Well, Michael Denny said, you've done 18 months out here now, and a year in the ship, and I'd like you to stay, but if you want, you leave. And if it hadn't been for Barbara, I'd have stayed, and I didn't think it was fair. And my poor young bride that I left behind, only 2 months married. So I said, I think I better go. So I went back. So when the whole fleet came back to Sydney, and I then disembarked, had my farewell piss up in Sydney, and flew back. The longest hop in the world, it was called in those days, by Qantas Airways, 16 hours and 5 minutes from Exmouth Gulf to Ratmalana.
I think you wanted to say something about the conditions of the sailors at sea in the war.
Yes. Well, the first thing is, the first really frightening thing was that when ships arrived out in the Far East, they all had people on board with UK rates of pay. The sailors that were ashore-based in the Far East all got local overseas allowance, which was quite a considerable income. Increase in their normal rate of pay. On the other hand, they also acted as a pool to replace casualties, sickness, and so forth for the ship's companies of ships that were out in the area. So that when you got your draft ship in the Far East, that is, from, shall we say, HMS Baranda, which was a nice, convenient air station to be on, and drafted to HMS Victorious, for duties at sea, what happened? You immediately suffered a catastrophic drop in pay. You lost your local overseas allowance. So the poor sailors, there was a tremendous discontent about this. By being forced to give up their soft perch, relatively soft, battle-free area in Ceylon, to go in these noisy, hot, overheated aircraft carrier or frigate or whatever other ship it was, they suffered this deduction in their pay. And after all, they'd all got wives and things and all them back in England, and this extra money helped them along quite a bit. But being forced to take a reduction of the pay to go and fight the Japanese really was a left-handed sort of thing to do. And there was a great very nearly a mutiny out there. I don't know whether anybody's really... all the officers, but everyone, was on the sailors' side. It was grossly unfair that they should be penalized for going to fight the enemy. That really, really is one of those madnesses, basically inspired by the civil service. The civil service were totally without imagination in all this matter. That was the very worst thing of all. The other point I'd like to mention about the sea time is that we were always doing in excess of 20 knots. We're probably 25 knots most of the time. And up to 30 knots on occasions for flying off duties and so on. Now, this produces a great strain in the ship. The noise is almost deafening. The fans, all the ships were only air-conditioned fans, that is to say, ventilated with ambient temperature stuff. They drew in moist and warm, moist air from the outside and blew it on through Punkah Wallahs. So if you stood underneath a fan, at least by some form of evaporation, you could feel a sort of chill, a temporary chill. But the whole temperature was high. Also, it was all right in daytime, but at night we had to darken ship. All scuttles were shut, all dead lights were down, and we couldn't afford not to have them all down. The ship was really closed up like a tin. So you could imagine thumping through the night at 25 knots with a wardroom of 120 people, all in shorts and Dread Sea rig and all that sort of stuff, all of some of them in flying gear, produced hot and humid atmosphere. It wasn't really at all healthy. And with all the noise and the rattle of a ship battling on, you never knew what was going to happen next. It was all dark and blackout, so you just knew you were going to the next flying off position. And to try and get sleep and rest in all those conditions imposed an enormous strain on individuals. It's all right, the people who had a job to do for driving the ship, because at least they were doing their job. But for aviators, whose air machines were in the hangars or on deck, were trying to get some form of relaxation from the tensions of flying that day in that sweaty, dreadful din. No one has yet attempted to describe, although I did once to a chap earlier on in this room some many years back, I still feel this almost amazing way that the human frame can stand this sort of treatment, day after day, week after week. The other thing is, when you sort of talk about hard liars or any form of recompense of any sort, none was given. So I think that I have to pay tribute to all those citizens that stood that type of treatment. The battleships had it very much more luxurious. They had large wardrooms with comfortable chairs. Of course, it never happened quite like that in battleships.
Can we jump ahead to the post-war period, to 1950-51, when I think you were in the jungle fighting the guerrillas in Malaya emergency with 40 Royal Marine Commando?
That's right, 40. 40 Commando, yes, well... we'd done on Hong Kong and stopped Mao Zedong from invading Hong Kong, that's what we say. I enjoyed Hong Kong. But then they thought, well, I have to tell you about Hong Kong, that we were told that when we set sail in the Georgic from Malta, that we were going out because if we didn't stop Mao, the English standard of living would drop by 20%. What a sort of extraordinary statement to read out to the troops as an excuse for sending us out to defend Hong Kong. And who are we? Just a commando brigade against all the mighty hordes of Japanese for 20%. Anyway, it didn't cut much ice with us. So when Mao decided he wasn't going to have trifle with Hong Kong, bypassed it, we were left without a job. We were in internal security anyway. So I got shifted as advance party to... They said, you go and fiddle with these Chinese bandits in Malaya. So I had great fun flying down to Singapore, and I met my old friend Duncan Smith there, who had a Spitfire squadron, and also one or two other friends, and Pete Brothers, who's now... You have done Pete Brothers?
Yes.
Oh, yes, I got a lovely certificate of Pete Brothers when he was only a squadron leader. He had a Lincoln, or was it a Shackleton? Lincoln, I think it was, four engine. So he flew me up from Tengah up to Butterworth, and I went to Penang to arrange for the commandos. I was the advance party, and we got settled, our particular commando, 40, in Kuala Kangsa. And the jungle wasn't very far off. We had Crow and one or two other places. It was nearest to the border. And we used to go out on 3-day stints. I was in headquarters at that time, so I didn't actually do too much of it. I went into the jungle once or twice. Leeches were very unpleasant. Sweaty, hot, always a sense of danger. But it's rather like Boy Scouts in many ways. Tracking the things down, and we had these super little chaps from Borneo. I can't remember their typical names. They were wonderful little
Ebans.
Yes, they were wonderful. They could tell by the bend of a blade of grass how many people had passed their way, whether they'd farted or not. And it is extraordinary how canny. So he'd go and examine everything else, and we'd lay out this and that and the other. So we didn't suffer many casualties. We killed about 5 Chinese bandits. I was invited to go to the hanging of one of them, but I refused. I thought it was rather unnecessary. I didn't like that sort of thing too much. So it wasn't an unpleasant time. I mean, we used to go on duty patrol squadron, or that sort of thing. So we kept a certain amount of peace, but most of the job really was traveling around an armored car, trying to cheer up the local planters, go and have a visit them, bring a bottle of whiskey and give them a drink, and you know, because the presence when they're all alone was quite something. I should say enjoy the jungle. A lot of people didn't like the jungle, but I did. I loved it.